Welcome to today's deep dive. If you are looking to buy an investment property, your very first instinct is probably to just open up a map.
Oh, absolutely. It's what everyone does.
Right. You look at neighborhoods, you check out proximity to downtown, or maybe you look for like a cute duplex in a trendy suburb.
Yeah, it feels like the most obvious, logical place to begin.
Exactly. But according to a foundational real estate framework we are looking at today, opening that map is actually the fastest way to guarantee you will lose money.
It is essentially putting the cart miles ahead of the horse. I mean, comparing locations or property types before doing anything else is, well, it's the fundamental mistake most novice investors make.
So true. And the central thesis of the source material we are reviewing, this guide titled Cash Flow versus Capital Growth, which property investment strategy fits your goals? It argues that the right first step requires ignoring the real estate market entirely.
Yeah, you really have to look inward first. You have to define exactly what you want the investment to achieve, specifically in the context of your own personal financial timeline.
Okay, let's unpack this, because this source material actually flips the entire real estate script on its head.
It really does.
It argues that diving into property investing without a deeply defined personal goal is exactly how you end up trapped. Like, you buy an asset that looks phenomenal on a spreadsheet.
Right. The numbers look great on paper.
Yeah, but it completely fails to serve your actual life needs. You could end up house rich, but cash poor, or just drowning in tenant management. Well, what you really needed was a hands-off inflation hedge.
And that is the core risk right there. We are talking about asset liability matching.
Which sounds super technical.
It does, but institutional investors do this all the time. They look at their future liabilities, like when they actually need to pay out money, and they buy assets that mature or generate yield at that exact moment.
But retail investors, like everyday people, they rarely think this way.
Exactly. They just try to buy a quote-unquote good property. But the guide outlines two very distinct primary strategies that operate almost like entirely different financial ecosystems.
Cash flow and capital growth.
You got it. Two totally different paths.
So let's break those down. The guide uses two specific examples, Sarah and David. With Sarah, well, she's looking to reduce her reliance on her monthly salary right now.
Right. Her needs are immediate.
Yeah, she wants investments that contribute toward her everyday living expenses in the near term. So she needs cash flow.
Yeah.
Let me guess. Sarah's strategy is essentially about bridging an immediate liquidity gap.
That is exactly the function of a cash flow strategy. It is laser focused on generating a steady, regular stream of rental income that actually exceeds the carrying costs of the property.
So she's making a profit every month.
Yes. The goal is to supplement a salary or just create immediate financial breathing room today.
Makes sense. And then we have David. Now, the guide notes David is 20 years away from retirement.
A completely different timeline.
Totally. He already has a salary that covers his day-to-day life comfortably. He doesn't need, grocery money today. He needs a massive nest egg 2 decades from now.
So he is the textbook candidate for capital growth.
Right.
David is playing a completely different game here. Instead of prioritizing immediate monthly yield, the focus of capital growth is on the long-term appreciation of the property's market value.
Even if the month-to-month numbers aren't as flashy.
Exactly. With this strategy, the rental income might just barely cover the expenses. Sometimes it might even operate at a slight negative yield initially.
Wait, really? You'd intentionally lose money every month.
Well, the investor choosing this path is absorbing that near-term illiquidity because the real payoff is a massive future lump sum when the property is sold or refinanced.
Wow. Reading through this, it struck me that choosing a property before setting your financial goal is kind of like walking into a hardware store and asking the clerk, which tool is best?
That's a great way to look at it.
Yeah, like asking that without actually knowing if you're building a birdhouse or fixing a car engine.
Yeah.
The tool isn't inherently good or bad. It just has to match the specific job.
The utility of the asset is entirely dependent on the desired end product.
But let me push back on David's strategy for a second. Is it genuinely realistic for an average person to wait 20 years for a capital growth return?
It can definitely feel daunting.
Right. Tying up hundreds of thousands of dollars, just crossing your fingers that the market goes up over 2 decades, sounds agonizing.
Mm-hmm.
Why would someone choose that wait over getting a tangible check every single month?
Well, to understand the why, we really have to look under the hood at the mechanics of leveraged appreciation and how it interacts with inflation. It is definitely not just crossing your fingers.
Okay, break that down for me.
Think about the math of a mortgage. You put down, say, 20% of the property's value. But when the property appreciates, you capture 100% of that growth.
Oh, right, because the bank doesn't get a share of the profits.
Exactly. So if a $1 million property goes up by 5%, that is $50,000 in equity. On your $200,000 down payment, that is a 25% return in a single year.
Driven purely by macroeconomic trends. That is wild when you frame it like that.
Right. So you are amplifying the market's natural upward drift through leverage. And there is a second invisible mechanic working in David's favor, which is inflation.
Usually inflation is the bad guy.
Usually, yes. But over a 20-year horizon, inflation steadily erodes the real value of debt. The mortgage balance David owes is fixed, but as the years pass, the currency he uses to pay off that debt is worth less.
While his underlying physical asset is inherently holding its real-world value.
Exactly. Furthermore, the tenant's modest rent is slowly paying down that principal balance. So you have an asset growing exponentially through leverage, a liability shrinking through inflation, and a tenant covering the carrying costs.
That combination builds profound generational wealth.
It really does. Huh. The 20-year wait is basically the price of admission for capturing that specific mathematical phenomenon.
That reframes it entirely. It's not a waiting game. It's an engine that needs time to run. So we have these two completely different engines. What happens when Sarah and David's strategies actually collide with the reality of the physical real estate market?
This is where we hit the physical trade-offs in the market. The guide highlights a fundamental law of real estate.
Which is?
Properties rarely perform equally across both metrics. An asset that delivers massive rental income today will almost always experience significantly slower price growth in the future.
Let me guess. It's because a high-yield property is usually in a stagnant neighborhood where the entry purchase price is just dirt cheap.
You are hitting right on the concept of capitalization rates, or cap rates.
The
famous cap rate.
Yes. Cap rate is simply the net operating income divided by the property's current market value. High-yield properties have high cap rates, and they're usually located in areas where property values are artificially low.
Because nobody wants to buy there.
Exactly. Those low values exist for a reason. They reflect slower economic growth, capped tenant demand, or a lack of incoming capital investment in that specific municipality.
So the rent-to-purchase price ratio looks incredibly favorable today, but the ceiling for future value is very low.
Spot on. The text highlights specific market factors that dictate this balance. You know, local economic conditions, population growth, infrastructure projects, supply and demand, and interest rates.
All the big macro drivers.
Yeah. And here's where it gets really interesting. Because as a new investor, your absolute basic instinct is to just chase the highest advertised rental yield. You look at a spreadsheet, you see a double-digit yield, and you think you've cracked the code.
It's a very common trap.
So if I see a property screaming high yield on paper, what is the hidden catch?
What's fascinating here is that the hidden catch is almost always time and the underlying municipal infrastructure. Sophisticated investors view this through a macroeconomic lens over a decade or more.
Okay, give me an example.
Let's take infrastructure projects because this completely warps the numbers. Imagine a city government issues municipal bonds to fund a massive new light rail expansion. It is a 10-year, multi-billion-dollar project.
Massive undertaking.
Right. If you buy a property right on that future transit line today, your current rental yield is going to be abysmal.
Well, yeah, because nobody wants to rent a place next to a massive, noisy construction zone where the streets are torn up for the next 5 years.
Exactly. The noise, the dust, the road closures, it severely depresses current tenant demand. A novice investor looks at that low cap rate and runs away.
But a veteran investor stays.
The marathon investor is looking at the tax increment financing districts and the urban zoning overlays. They know that when a city commits to a transit hub, they eventually rezone the surrounding half-mile radius for high-density mixed-use development.
Oh, wow.
They change the floor area ratios. So in 10 years, when the ribbon is cut, not only will commuters pay a massive premium to live 12 minutes from downtown, but the land itself might be rezoned to allow for a 5-story apartment building instead of a single-family home.
Okay, I love how you just completely nerded out over municipal tax increment financing and floor area ratios there, but it perfectly illustrates the mechanism.
I can't help it. The mechanics are fascinating.
They really are. The novice sees a construction site, but the veteran sees a future rezoning windfall. They are purposely absorbing a decade of terrible cash flow to capture a monumental cap rate compression event in the future.
Exactly. They are trading today's comfort for tomorrow's payout. It is a calculated absorption of near-term pain.
But if every single property comes with these intense structural trade-offs, you know, the noisy construction zone versus the high-yield stagnant neighborhood, are we forced to pick just one extreme? Like, is it always a binary choice?
It is not strictly binary, no. And the guide clarifies that this is a spectrum. The text actually references broader principles of capital appreciation, often discussed in resources like Investopedia, showing that hybrid approaches are standard practice.
So you find the middle ground.
Yes. Many properties offer a combination of both income and growth. You might find a property that generates reliable, decent rental income while also experiencing steady, moderate value increases.
Right.
However, the core takeaway is that one characteristic will always take the lead based on the intrinsic nature of the market. Your personal timeline dictates which side of that spectrum you should prioritize.
But here is the massive elephant in the room that the guide's theory runs right into: budget constraints.
Yes. The barrier to entry.
Purchasing an entire investment property requires massive capital. We are talking about a huge down payment, closing costs, underwriting fees, and, you know, a reserve budget for when the roof inevitably leaks.
Which it always does.
Always. Because it is so intensely expensive to get into this asset class, it essentially forces most people to make an agonizing binary choice anyway. If you only have enough cash for one down payment, you are forced to choose one cash flow property or one capital growth property.
It's true for most individuals.
Because you can't afford to buy both a downtown growth condo and a suburban cash flow duplex.
You are describing concentration risk, and it is the primary historical barrier to entry in real estate. Buying a physical building traditionally demands an illiquidity premium.
Meaning your money is just stuck there.
Exactly. You are tying up a massive percentage of your net worth in a single, highly localized, illiquid asset. If the major employer in that one specific town goes bankrupt, your entire portfolio suffers.
Which is terrifying for a retail investor. So how do you circumvent that?
The guide points to a highly effective mechanical solution highlighted by Usul Gamma, which is fractional property ownership.
Okay, fractional ownership.
Yes. This completely dismantles the traditional illiquidity barrier. Instead of one person pooling all their net worth to buy an entire property, fractional ownership utilizes specialized financial structures, often special purpose vehicles or LLCs, to acquire the asset outright.
And then they slice it up?
Exactly. The equity in that entity is then divided into shares, allowing multiple investors to own a fraction of an income-generating property.
So instead of one person footing the bill for an entire catering buffet, you are essentially splitting the check among 100 friends, but everyone still gets to eat.
That is a perfect analogy. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, fractional ownership is revolutionary because it fundamentally solves the budget constraint and concentration risk problems.
How so?
Well, let's say you have $50,000 to invest. Historically, that might barely cover one down payment, forcing you to lock into one strategy and take on a heavy mortgage burden.
Right. All your eggs in one basket.
With fractional ownership, you deploy that exact same capital across multiple shares in different properties and asset classes.
Oh, I see. So I could put a portion of my money into a high-yield, cash flow-focused residential building in the Midwest and simultaneously deploy another portion into a high-growth commercial development on the coast.
Yes, exactly. You are creating a balanced, diversified portfolio of both cash flow and capital growth without needing millions of dollars up front.
That's incredible.
And crucially, it removes the operational friction. Because the asset is held in a centralized structure, professional property management handles the leaky roofs and the tenant disputes.
So no midnight phone calls about a broken toilet.
None at all. The rental income is distributed proportionally as dividends. You get the macroeconomic benefits of real estate, the inflation hedging, the leverage, the yield, without the operational headaches or the massive localized risk.
That completely changes the accessibility of the asset class. Instead of putting all my eggs in one massive, geographically isolated basket, I can essentially build a custom, highly liquid mini portfolio tailored exactly to my changing life circumstances.
It offers agility in a market that has spent centuries being famously rigid. If you need income today, you overweight your portfolio with shares and cash flow properties.
And then switch it up later.
Exactly. If your salary increases next year and you want to chase long-term wealth, you pivot and allocate new capital toward growth-focused shares.
It brings all these market mechanics, you know, the cap rates, the infrastructure zoning, the fractional ownership structures, right back to the ultimate decision maker, which is you, the listener. So what does this all mean?
It comes down to knowing yourself.
Right. The guide is very clear on the ultimate lesson from experienced investors, which is never, ever copy someone else's decisions.
Mm-hmm. Mimicry is perhaps the most dangerous trap in investing. The property that is a mathematical gold mine for your neighbor might be a catastrophic failure for you.
Because your lives are different.
Exactly. Their liquidity needs, their time horizon, their risk tolerance, and their tax brackets are entirely different from yours. Comparing your journey to theirs leads to emotional decisions that feel exciting today, but actively sabotage your actual financial future.
The guide offers an exact quote that I think needs to be written on a sticky note and put on every investor's computer monitor. It is the filter for every single decision.
What's the quote?
The quote is, "What role do I want this investment to play in my life?"
That strips away all the noise. When you have a defined mandate for your capital, whether that's paying for a child's university tuition in 10 years or just supplementing your grocery bill next month, it becomes incredibly easy to ignore market fads.
You stop caring about the hottest new neighborhood if it doesn't fit your plan.
Exactly. You ignore it if the underlying mechanics of that market don't align with the specific role you need that asset to play.
It really emphasizes that property investing is a deeply personal journey. Defining your own destination is the only mathematical way to evaluate if an opportunity is truly a fit for you.
This raises an important question, though, and it's something to really reflect on as we wrap up.
Okay, lay it on us.
If our property investment should be entirely dictated by our current life goals, how often should we be reevaluating those goals? Because human life is not static. What happens when your circumstances inevitably change?
Right, like transitioning from Sarah to David.
Exactly. Let's say you start out as Sarah. You need that cash flow to survive your 20s. But then 2 decades pass. Your income stabilizes, you get promoted, and suddenly you look a lot more like David, needing long-term wealth for retirement.
That's a huge demographic shift.
When that shift happens, does your entire physical property portfolio need to be painfully liquidated, taxed, and swapped out? Or, leveraging tools like fractional ownership, is there a way to design a dynamic portfolio from the very beginning that automatically shapeshifts, rebalancing its yield and growth profiles right alongside your own aging process?
That is a fascinating thought to chew on. Can your real estate portfolio essentially grow up with you, evolving its function as your life changes? It all starts with knowing exactly what you are building today and ignoring the map until you do. Keep that in mind the next time you find yourself scrolling through real estate listings. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We will see you next time.